Yes.
Okay. Morning, the E12 Finance Division is called to order. Today is March 18, 2014. We have five bills before us. First is Senate File 530, Senator Dahl. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Wieger and members. I have Senate File 530. This bill has been heard in policy, and we're now, of course, before your committee very briefly, and I have some testifiers that will also give some more context to the bill. But this bill authorized the Purpich Center for the Arts Education to operate the Crosswinds School, a voluntary integration magnet school that's currently operated by the East Metro Integration District. This bill would transfer staff and state facilities. EMID Board of Directors voted on January of 2013 to convey governance and facilities of the Crosswinds Arts and Science School, Magnet School for Voluntary Integration, to Purpich Center for Arts. Transition of the Crosswinds School to the Purpich Center would protect 54 jobs for employees who have received notice of unrequested leave effective August 1st of 2013. And under the Purpich Center governance, Crosswinds would continue to be operated as a school of choice for parents seeking public school options that best meet the needs of their students and those seeking a school providing voluntary integration and diverse educational environment. I do have an amendment, the A5 amendment, and if could have maybe Mr. Arneson explain what the amendment does, gives a little better clarity to that.
Mr. Arneson, on the A5, and as I indicated, we'll act on that when we have one more member arrive for a quorum, and it is embraced in the committee unofficial engrossment as well. Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair, and
A5.
Members, so I'm looking at the
members, a quorum is present, and Senator Dahl moves the A5 author's amendment, which is to be explained by Mr. Arneson. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Adopted. Mr. Arneson on the A5.
Mr. Chair and members, so the document marked A5 adds a few provisions that serve to bring the fiscal cost of this bill near to zero. The first of that, first of those, is on lines 3 through 11 of the amendment. It would provide that for fiscal years 2015, 16, and 17, a pupil enrolled at the Crosswinds School shall not generate declining enrollment revenue for the district or charter in which the pupil was last counted in average daily membership. So these pupils enrolled at Crosswinds will all be coming from other serving districts prior to their official enrollment in Crosswinds. And this new paragraph in 126C10 would indicate that those pupils shouldn't generate declining enrollment for their previous district. Lines 12 and 13, our technical amendment to not withstand Minnesota rules that would otherwise normally qualify a district for integration, achievement of integration revenue. Lines 14 and 15 require that in fiscal 16 and later, the board, meaning the board of the Crosswinds Purpich, must have an approved achievement integration plan and budget under the achievement and integration statute. Lines 16 through 16 and 17, rather, are technical adjustment to ensure that declining enrollment aid at the Crosswinds School is calculated on actual declining enrollment rather than the statewide average declining enrollment. Lines 18 through 21 of the amendment indicate that for fiscal 15 only, transportation to the Crosswinds School is the responsibility of a member district of the Joint Powers EMID district, and that a district in that group has the responsibility to transport students in the same manner as they are transported in fiscal 14. For fiscal 16 and thereafter, transportation would be the responsibility of the Crosswinds School. Line 22 deletes line 26, and give me a moment to identify what that is. Technical adjustment related to the transportation, and the remaining lines in the amendment are technical deletions.
Thank you. Mr. Arneson and Senator Dahl, I'm going to ask Mr. Wilms, our fiscal analyst, to elaborate further. We do not have a final fiscal note. It's in progress. And I believe Dr. Melcher or, you know, someone's here, and I don't know if anyone's here from the Office of Budget Management regarding the issue on whether this needs on a three-fifths vote to go to bonding or not, but maybe we can get clarifications. There's a very good awareness by members about the need for and what the accomplishments of the school and the partnership, but the focus right now is on sharpening these numbers. So if we could go to Mr. Wilms, and then I'll ask if Dr. Melcher or someone from the department is and others to clarify what we have before us, and then we can proceed with testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to start by just referencing the fiscal note in your packet. It's based on Senate File 530, but it is from a year ago. So I'd like to note that the note has changed considerably with the evolution of the language. For your reference, the most recent fiscal note we have similar to this is for House File 9979, if you want to reference that instead, but we do not have...
Let's make sure everybody, there's a lot of paper here, and we have two documents.
Well, we do not have the House file distributed in committee because it's not based on the current language that it was introduced today. So the language that was just introduced, the amendment, a fiscal note has been requested on that language. Okay. The House file indicates that a lot of the fiscal impact comes from declining enrollment aid, and the A5 amendment seeks to remedy that. But I can't give official word on the fiscal impact until we get that note back. But I wanted to clarify that it has been requested, and so we should receive it from the department.
Thank you. And is Dr. Melcher or like to comment on the timing on that request? Welcome, Dr. Melcher.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. We did get the request for the revised fiscal note with the new language yesterday afternoon. We had staff people working on it when I left about 5:30 last night. They were getting pretty close, so we expect something would be ready today. And we expect that with the new declining enrollment language that the fiscal note will come out with a slight savings to the state rather than a cost. But we don't have anything official until the fiscal note is fully reviewed and completed.
And Dr. Melcher, discussions with MMB, that off?
We do that after we get the fiscal note drafted, then it goes to MMB. So we don't have any official numbers at this point in time, but it appeared that the fiscal impact was primarily coming from the declining enrollment language, which would now be taken care of. And so we don't expect that there will be a cost, but we can't say anything official until we finish it and then MMB has a chance to look at it.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hopefully if any members have any questions about the financial implications, this would be the time to ask, obviously, but that's as good as we have right now in terms of information, and wish we could have got some of that sooner. But we know how busy folks are, and we appreciate the work that they are doing. Again, I do have a few testifiers, and I'm going to ask them to be very brief. I think, again, we had a robust discussion in policy, and so maybe just a few minute or so, if that, from any of my testifiers today.
First, Senator Dahl, we have a couple of questions. I believe Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, yes. Mr. Chairman. I do need to ask Dr. Melcher a question. Thank you, Dr. Melcher and Senator Dahl. I'm curious about your statement with respect to the cost being less when we got because of enrollment, because of the decline in enrollment. Wouldn't the ratio be the opposite because the responsibility of the state to this particular to the purpose, you know, is kind of different. We have to provide for the maintenance efforts and everything for the school, for buildings and everything. And if we don't have students, if we have a decline, the responsibility of the state is higher. I think that has been actually the actual core concern about this issue. Number one, that we are setting a precedent in terms of a school that has a decline in enrollment and has, you know, and is now trying to kind of solve that problem by kind of going to perpetuate. And so we are responsible for perpetuate, and we will have to actually take care of the cost. Could you clarify that?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres-Ray, the primary source of cost in the earlier version of the fiscal note was the decline in enrollment in the member school districts, primarily St. Paul, because of the change in the flow of the money. So what used to be the case was that the state would pay general education revenue to the St. Paul School District, and then the St. Paul School District would contract with EMID to provide the education. So essentially, the from a state's perspective, we were paying St. Paul, and then St. Paul was contracting to provide the education. When we changed this and we now pay Crosswinds directly, what happens is the pupil units that are reported by the St. Paul School District go down. And because St. Paul is basically stable, they've got a slight decline in their enrollment that they are predicting. What this does is it increases the declining enrollment aid that we pay to St. Paul because they're no longer reporting those students. But it was kind of an artificial thing because St. Paul wasn't educating the students anyway, so we were paying them declining enrollment aid as if they had lost students. The whole idea of declining enrollment aid is your enrollment's going down, therefore you've got, you know, half-empty buildings that you're still heating, and you may be laying off teachers, and you're laying off the lowest-paid teachers first, so your cost goes up. But that doesn't really fit this situation because St. Paul was just kind of the fiscal agent for the money. They weren't providing the education for these students. So there's some... it was kind of creating an artificial increase in the declining enrollment aid that we pay to St. Paul. I think your question was relating to some other longer-term costs that might be there. But the fiscal note that we did, the impact was primarily declining enrollment aid paid to St. Paul that was kind of an artificial increase in funding for them because of the change in the pupil accounting structure.
Interesting. Thank you.
Sarah Kent.
I know this is sort of tough to sort out between the way things have been because we've operated under such a completely different model and then what we're talking about moving ahead. I'm trying to, and I know we don't have a fiscal note, so I know it makes it a little more complicated to think about this moving forward. But sort of all that you just described aside, thinking ahead, and the idea that there's this building that it has a cost to keep open and heat and provide power. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, coming from the private sector, I tend to think about this in an operational perspective.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you know, we need enough students to sort of cover the basic costs, right? Mm-hmm. And then, so I guess that would be my question. I know a fiscal note is coming. I don't know if that's something that's available information at this point. What is that cost? Mm-hmm. And what is that number of students for sort of break even?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kent, the way that we construct the fiscal notes, we're looking at the cost to the state rather than the cost to the school district. So when we look at the cost, we look at most of the money that we're paying out is in the general education program or the integration program. It's the money that we're paying so that they can continue to operate. So currently we're paying the St. Paul district and other districts that were members of EMID to educate those students. They're contracting and EMID was providing the service, and now that's changing. So the the fundamental amount of money we're paying out from the state to the school isn't changing in any significant way, because this bill says we're going to pay basically the state average rate of funding for most of our categories. And I think in reality, the state average might be a little lower than what we were paying those districts. So we might end up with a very small negative number coming out as our fiscal note. Now, that's a whole different issue in terms of what does it take to keep that building open. That doesn't really show up in our fiscal note, because that's something that we treat as a kind of a local budgeting decision. And so essentially that becomes more of a long-term viability kind of issue. And we don't really assess that in our fiscal note. We're just looking at what is it going to cost the state in 2015, 2016, and 2017 in terms of the flow of general education revenue, integration revenue, and so forth, and whether or not that district is going to, or that school is going to be viable in the long term is really a separate issue that's not really addressed in our fiscal note.
Mm-hmm. Further questions at this point of Dr. Melcher? Okay, Senator Dahl, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps at least one of our testifiers could maybe address some of the concerns that Senator Kent has. I think I'm going to go by what I see on the agenda here, and if that wants to change, I'll call up Gene Lupke and Katie Goggins, give brief testimony if they would.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Just introduce yourself. Thank you, Chair Wieger, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about EMID and our desire to convey our schools. My name is Jean Lubke. I'm the executive director of the East Metro Integration District. It's known as EMID. It is a collaborative integration district with 10 member districts of the East Metro. You have a handout with a map, including the names of the districts. For nearly 15 years, EMID has operated the two integration schools, Harumbe in Maplewood and Crosswinds Arts and Science School in Woodbury. Both are year-round schools. The schools are in buildings that were bonded for by the state for the purpose of integration. These are magnet schools that voluntarily draw students from all of our member districts for the purpose of having an educational experience in an integrated setting. While the schools have served their purpose of providing that integrated learning experience for students and staff in the schools very well, there was not the infrastructure established to share that learning and impact back with the other member, with the 10 member districts. And while the two schools were clearly benefiting those who were participating, the amount of time and resources needed to run the schools diminished the time and resources that the small EMID staff and Joint Powers Board could spend on integration efforts across the member districts to help them increase equity. Over the past funding cycles, the uncertainty of the integration revenue also caused the member districts to be nervous about continuing to operate the schools. As a collaborative, the member districts participated in long-range strategic planning, and in the winter of 2013, the EMID board decided to move away from the business of running the schools and to find districts which were willing and able to continue the schools. Roseville and Purpich emerged as districts which were willing to continue the running of Harumbe and Crosswinds as multi-district integration schools in keeping with the original legislation. The Purpich Center was particularly qualified to continue the arts focus for Crosswinds. No other districts were willing to continue the school programming, although others were interested in obtaining the buildings for other purposes. With a new focus on achievement in the achievement and integration legislation, the member districts believe that EMID will best meet their needs by direct service to the districts rather than by running schools. As a collaborative, we're having cross-district professional development and leadership discussions about the barriers to achievement. We're collaboratively identifying the measurements we need to determine the impact of integration work within our districts, and we're collaboratively beginning a project to create a solid pipeline for getting students and teachers of color, students and adults of color into the classroom. Together, we share our best practices. We're focused on, this year, early learning, college and career readiness, family engagement, and equity and cultural competence. We're working to define the new EMID, and we strongly believe that an integrated experience is an important option for students in the East Metro to have. The schools are offering that wonderful education experience, but running and managing the schools is not in the best interest of EMID's resources if the goal for us is to close the achievement gap for all East Metro students. So Roseville Public Schools and Purpich Center are managing the two schools this year and are showing that they have the interest and the capability to grow and sustain these schools for the students in the East Metro area. The EMID Board unanimously passed a legislative platform in November 2013 supporting their continued operation and conveyance of Harumbe to Roseville and of Crosswinds to the Purpich Center. We ask that the legislation to convey these schools to these districts be approved so the students may continue to have their integrated experience and that the EMID districts may move forward to collaborate on our achievement and equity work. Thank you for your time and attention. I now turn over to Kitty Goggins, the chair of the EMID Joint Powers Board.
Thank you, Dr. Lupke.
Ms. Goggins. Mr. Chair and honorable senators, my name is Kitty Goggins. I am the current chair of the East Metro Integration District School Board. I serve on the EMID Board as the Roseville Area School Board representative. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about the EMID Board's desire to convey our schools. The EMID Board, which includes a representative from each of the 10 member districts, unanimously supports conveyance of the schools. We reached this position after extensive analysis of the situation. We've had to balance the needs of the students who selected to attend EMID schools with the needs of all students attending member districts. We ask that the legislation to convey these schools be approved so that the students who have chosen to attend our EMID schools may continue their integrated experience, and that the EMID districts may accelerate moving forward to collaborate on our achievement and equity work to benefit all 103,000 students in our member districts.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think we'll call up Sue Mackert, Executive Director of the Purpich Center for Arts, and Dr. Carla Hines.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it really is time to pass Senate File 530 and let your state agency, the Purpich Center for Arts Education, use the power of arts education to engage students in lifelong success. The Minnesota legislature exhibited unprecedented foresight in establishing three integration districts and providing special funding to these urban-suburban collaboratives as a means to desegregate schools and establish equitable learning opportunities for students of color. In the past 10 years, EMID member school districts have received an investment of about $350 million in integration revenue. Progress has been made, with continued improvement projected. Graduation rates and high school dropout rates among Minnesota students of color are unacceptable. So when Purpich Center for Arts Education was invited to take over Crosswinds Arts and Science School, we considered it our obligation as a state agency to protect this valuable state asset and to maximize its use. As many of you know, for about 30 years now, almost, Purpich Center has helped schools develop and implement programs based on research and best practices to meet the needs of their school communities. We have worked with elementary, middle, secondary, and high schools in every county of the state, rural, urban, and suburban, handling issues from economic stress to emerging demographic shifts to teacher recruitment. Purpich entered into an operational agreement with EMID in July. We received final approval from MMB in August, and we opened school September 3rd. In less than a month, Crosswinds grew from zero students to 174, and our retention is solid. Our projected growth calls for about 50 new students per year over the next 3 years, and we are on track to meet those goals. Sustainability of Crosswinds will come in the form of innovative programming, leveraging people and managerial resources, obtaining alternative sources of funding through grants and leases, and forging external partnerships. We would like to bring the school back to a time when it was, in fact, very financially sound and was able to build a reserve, and that will happen. We are proud to be working with the state's councils of color and have formed an advisory group consisting of leaders, parents, social and human service professionals, and representatives from Latino, Asian Pacific, African American, Somali American, and Native American Indian groups. Foundation and community leaders who have interest in Minnesota's student achievement are joining that advisory. They include Ramla Bile from the Minneapolis Foundation, Bobby Cordano of the Wilder Foundation, and former St. Paul Mayor and Hamline University professor and Humphrey Institute scholar Jim Scheibel. We are participating in celebrations of diversity and working with Main Street and ethnic media. Crosswinds was conceived to challenge an integration crisis. Solid evidence shows that it was and can be an effective model. As a student recently said to me when I was talking about the legislature and Crosswinds, let's just do it. Thank you. I would now like, Mr. Chair, if you will, to have Dr. Carla Hines, who's principal of Crosswinds, share some of her thoughts.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Hines.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Carlandria Hines, principal at Crosswinds Arts and Science School. Today, I have the privilege to speak to you about Crosswinds, what we have to offer our students and future teachers in the state of Minnesota. Crosswinds Arts and Science School is a 6-10 integration magnet school where we create a culturally diverse education community where each student's special talents and needs are nurtured and developed. Crosswinds offers students from diverse ethnic, socioeconomic, and religious backgrounds the opportunity to gain a voice, which traditional schools is not accepted in most school environments, and to create a community where student differences are celebrated and honored. Starting in the fall of 2013, Crosswinds, under the governance of Purpose Center for Arts Education, began offering a solid arts education. When art is infused into classes, students begin to connect visualization with reading comprehension, contextualizing math, and bringing experiential context to the sciences and humanities. Art infusion requires collaboration, research, intentional alignment, and practical application on the behalf of the teachers, and encourages students to create, investigate, appreciate, question curriculum in ways that develop cultural critical thinking skills. We also began to focus more on the art of science. With the use of our 37-acre campus, we are practicing design thinking in ways that are fostering our students to become responsible global citizens and environmental stewards. Through the implementation of art science, students' pursuit of innovative art and design ideas are at the cutting edge of science, fostering our students to become future engineers, innovators, and entrepreneurs. At Crosswinds, we understand the pivotal role a teacher plays in a student's educational career. We also understand how the Crosswinds school community can play an essential role in helping to shape and mold teachers to be culturally competent and responsive in their teaching practice. Just this year, we have been approached by pre-service and licensed teachers seeking opportunities to complete student teaching hours in a school setting focuses on creating a culturally diverse educational community. We know that the demographics of the teaching profession in the state of Minnesota is 97% white, and the demographics of the student populations is becoming more diverse. There is a strong need to provide teachers a non-evaluative environment to learn skills that are culturally contextual to the learning styles of the student population. Crosswinds will develop a teacher institute where its mission is to provide pre-service seasoned teachers a place to develop best practice teaching strategies to serve the needs of all Minnesota students. As a school administrator that has had an opportunity to serve in multiple districts in the state, I know the importance of students having a safe, welcoming school environment. In less than a year, I have seen Crosswinds transform both teachers and students. I have seen teachers coming from varying teaching backgrounds have many aha moments as they reflect on their lessons and strategies to identify hidden biases in their curriculum that tend to deter students from engaging in the lesson. I have seen students who have thought they could never be successful in school find their voice through learning contextual skills in the arts that allow them to make connections and realizations in their content areas. Students that first considered themselves failures and worthless are now having conversations as to how they want to contribute to the world when they grow up. Crosswinds is a school choice that students and parents should have in the East Metro. As a school administrator of color and as a parent of two African-American young men, I am here advocating for a culturally diverse school choice that would allow those who do not have a voice at the table an opportunity to be heard. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Hines. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is more of a question regarding the future performance that teachers will have to be evaluated. If, you know, I think the Crosswinds could not become a member of the the $260, what is that, the
for Q-Comp?
Q-Comp. Can Crosswinds become part of a Q-Comp participant as the way it's structured under Perpich?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I believe we can become a member. Right now, part of what's happening at the Arts High School is that we are, in fact, a test site for teacher evaluation, and we will move that model, and we do have some funds granted from the Department of Ed to exercise that, and we will move that model into Crosswinds. I would assume that once legislation is complete, that we would, in fact, qualify if, in fact, QComp will continue. So I appreciate you raising that, and we will put it on our list as potential income.
Okay. With currently, I suppose you operate strictly on the grant side of it, because there's two components to QComp. One is the grant, and the other is the levy. So Crosswinds won't have a levy base, and neither does Perpich. So it's just the grant portion that you're currently functioning or operating under?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, absolutely. That is, we will not and do not ask for the ability to levy. So it will be the grant portion.
Thank you.
And I suspect we'll have a lot of future discussion on that subject, so evaluation, QComp, et cetera. Okay. Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair. Just a couple more, couple of parents and a student to wrap up. If we could have them come forward for just some brief testimony. I believe Eric Celeste is first. Okay, and Kylie is going to go first, I guess. Kylie Taylor.
Okay. Welcome.
Go ahead. Good morning, senators and all gathered. My name is Kylie Taylor, and I've attended Crosswinds for 4 years. Crosswinds has made it possible for me and many other kids to experience integrated learning. Without our busing system, many of the kids from other districts would not be able to learn altogether. At Crosswinds, integration means walking into our lunchroom and seeing every different ethnicity sitting at a table together. It's not just Caucasian at one or Hispanic at another. It's both sitting together. Walking to our classroom, you will see everyone working together and learning. Just because one kid learns differently from the rest doesn't mean they are excluded. Most of the time, you won't even notice the difference that the student may have, mainly because of our teacher's ability to teach everyone individually in any way needed. Many of the friends I've made at Crosswinds would not have been possible without our integrated and the importance of this felt through the parents, teachers, and students. Many of the parents and kids fight to keep this school open. I want this school to remain open so other kids in the future can experience integration the way I did. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for this opportunity to testify. My name is Eric Celeste, and I'm the dad of two Crosswinds graduates. And I'm here to testify for a group of current and former EMID families who decided to honor your tight time in this committee by limiting our testimony to just a couple representatives. We strongly support Senate File 530 and the conveyance of Crosswinds and its wonderful program to the Purpitt Center for Arts Education. We have been advocating for Crosswinds for many years, and we were disappointed when we heard the experience of families misinterpreted at the last hearing for this bill. The decline in Crosswinds enrollment since 2008 was interpreted as a critique of the program, especially when compared to the steady enrollment at Crosswinds sister school, Harambe. Let me be very clear. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, you all received a letter from one parent of children at both schools, Laurel LeBlanc, describing the vast difference in the context of these schools over the past 5 years. While the East Metro Integration District Board was threatening to shut down both schools, it was always understood that should that happen, the Roseville Area School District would step in and continue the program at Harambe in as seamless a way as possible. Meanwhile, at Crosswinds, there was never such an assurance. Over those years, we weathered four superintendent transitions, resisted two attempts by the board to divest itself of the schools, withstood the loss of special integration funding for the schools, and suffered last year's failure of the legislature to convey the school to Purpitch. Then the unthinkable happened. The EMID board, which had twice tried to close the school, overwhelmingly decided instead to let the program continue under the management of Purpitch this year. That was in July. As many of you who are parents of school-aged kids realize, the season for settling your school choices is in January and February. All of us here had to prepare Plan Bs, and we encouraged every family at Crosswinds to do the same. By the time the school board had approved Purpitch management of Crosswinds in July, every student at Crosswinds was enrolled in another district. Everyone. We were effectively at an enrollment of zero. The real indicator of the value of the Crosswinds program is not the enrollment decline over the 5 years of battery from those trying to capture integration funds to cover funding gaps. The families who left consistently begged the EMID board for stable governance so that they could have the confidence they needed to stay at a school that was serving them so well. No, the real indicator, the real miracle, was that in less than 1 month, Crosswinds enrollment rose from zero to 194 that you see today, and we're still growing. Crosswinds has been badly hurt by the actions of its Joint Powers Board and by the refusal of this body to hear this bill in the last session. It has been badly hurt, but it is a fantastic program waiting to be stronger than it ever was under the stable and effective governance of the Purpitch Center for Arts Education. You here today have the power to be our heroes and the heroes of true integration in the East Metro. Please work with families, teachers, and the Purpitch Center to build a model for integration that will serve Minnesota for many years to come. Please support Senate File 530.
Thank you, Mr. Celeste.
Thank you, Chair and Senate members. My name is Mike Boguszewski. I have two children who are alums of the Crosswinds School and a daughter who also had gone to Harambe before that. I'll be very brief, and I'll say, you know, from today and looking forward, I think I'm very representative of the parents who appreciate that you are hearing this today and hope that you can support it and set a precedent, I guess, for this kind of situation, which is unique, just as the schools are unique and Crosswinds is unique. I think that's why we're all here. We represent today just the very, very needle tip of an iceberg of hundreds of parents who have stayed completely actively engaged in this for the last 2 to 3 years as all the funding has come into question. As you know, on short notice, it's hard for parents maybe to make it down here, so I hope this reflects the value we feel about this school. And I think it's because it is unique. This is not just another neighborhood school. It is a place, as we've said, I don't need to gild the lily, for voluntary integration. My wife and I, our family, chose this school for our children intentionally to experience that kind of environment. And as you could hear from many here, many of these parents don't feel it's hyperbole to say that these schools literally save their kids' lives. You know, whether that's literally physically true or whether it's just a life lost because of unmet expectations or the inability to not just thrive but to succeed at all in a school environment because of your differences, because you were born differently than the majority, whether that difference is your color, your ethnicity, what language you speak at home, your economic level, being labeled as behaviorally disabled in some way, or just another way being unique or weird or strange. The school exists to bring those folks together in a way that everybody wants to come together and make this environment work, and it does work. As parents, we know that the environment there is one of true integration, not just diversity, and the achievement gap is being dealt with there in a big way, and our hope is that Purpich, with its experience infrastructure, can help, as Sue Mackert alluded to earlier, fulfill even more strongly that mission of dissemination of techniques and tools and how to do that, how to create that environment, and really serve its learning lab purpose. You know, which is very different from the unintended consequences we're seeing read in the papers all the time of, you know, as some have alluded to, Minnesota is failing at our achievement gap. The open enrollment has just been a mechanism for white flight. This is the exact opposite of that. It's voluntarily families, my own family, where we don't have a minority student, choosing this environment voluntarily and actually actively going to a school that's more integrated versus less. So we do implore you to move this on to whatever level is next. Obviously, the funding is complicated. You're stewards of that. That's what you're charged to do. Help us find a way and help yourself be heroes in the process, I think, by saving this model. That's what it was bonded for. That's the mission of this property. Help us keep it in place under Purpich's stewardship. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bogusiewski. And if each of the persons standing, if you'd like to identify yourself, just a brief, you know, statement as to your involvement for our record. Yeah, it's optional. Maybe we start from the right. I know you're not bashful.
Oh, I'm Megan Kaczmarski.
Maybe closer to the mic, please.
I'm Megan Kaczmarski. I'm in 11th grade. I went to Crosswinds last year. This is my mom.
Hi, my name's Tammy Bain Kaczmarski.
Thank you.
My name's Dan Larson, and I had students at both Crosswinds and Purpich.
My name is Terrence Taylor, and I'm the father of Kylie.
I'm Holly Ingersoll, and I have a 7th grader at Crosswinds.
My name is Thomas Bogusiewski. I am an alumnus of Crosswinds and Purpich, and I also taught there.
Thank you.
I'm Xander Danielson-Selly, and I was at Crosswinds from 7th to 10th grade.
Xander, you've been camped out here. So, assistance. Okay.
My name is Dr. Mary Hess. I have two children who have graduated from these schools, one who went all the way from Harambe through Crosswinds.
Yeah, maybe I'll just, a final comment, Xander is the culmination of that. You know, the upside, the unintended good consequence of all this parent activity and involvement is that many of our students have really gotten a literal, you know, hands-on education at how our government works and how representation works. So it's been really fascinating for a lot of them. And hopefully it's encouraged a lot of our students to fill some of these seats in the future as they move on. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I would I'll take your direction on Senate File 530. I'd move Senate File 530 as amended. And is that for possible inclusion, or is that to finance? Or excuse me.
Yes. At this point, it would be, you know, laid over for possible inclusion. We await the fiscal note. I would imagine that would be within a day or so. And also, as I indicated, you know, Commissioner Showalter, we'd like to see if there's implications regarding the bonding bill. Senator Stump needs to know that. We need to know that. And as, you know, it was acknowledged in testimony, there are some very important financial details that we have to make sure of. In terms of, I'll just offer, in terms of the need, I think, you know, that's been conveyed very clearly, the testimony from parents and students and the value. And I'll share on a personal note, many of you know I was on the school board, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale before I got here. I was on the founding board of directors for Crosswinds as a joint venture, and Mary Ciccone, who then was Stillwater School Board. We remember what the vision, what the dream was. It's still alive. We understand. And so it's great to see a couple generations go through. And for Harambe as well, that was started when I got together with Representative Greiling at the time, who was the chair of the Roseville School Board. I was the chair of the North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, and then Mark Manderscheid in St. Paul School District. And we recognized the importance of additional choices to meet more needs of students. So I'm sure we're going to get there. We've got to work on some of these details. And so we appreciate your active, robust participation in the process. And as they say, sometimes patience is bitter, but its fruit is sweet. So we have a motion. Is there further discussion on the motion to lay over? Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, just wanted to say thank you to Purpich, because I'm a recipient in the West Metro of Purpich Arts Education and can tell you what a difference it makes to our community. And if we could spread their ability to infuse art into classrooms, if we could find ways to spread that all over the state, we would be better served. So thanks for bringing that forward.
Further comments? Not all on Senator Dahl's motion. In favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Carried. Thank you, Senator Dahl.
Thank you.
And we'll take a one-minute break so testifiers and others can leave, and we'll let, if they are welcome to listen to the remainder of the agenda, but we know there's several here. And Senator Clausen, if you could get ready with your testifiers, and we'll resume in 1 minute.
Thank you, Senator.
That's the last one.
Leroy,
probably called out of here again, too.
Did you have your interview?
Not yet.
I was thinking about that.
It's like Tate first. That's what they want first. And then.
Yeah. Senator. Senator Clausen, we have Senate File 1795. East Levy. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Senator Wieger and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1795. It's a bill to increase local school district lease levy capacity. The Minnesota legislature created the ability for local school boards to make an additional non-voter approved property tax levy to rent or lease buildings for instructional purposes. Senate File 1795 amends Minnesota Statute 2012, Section 126C.40, Subsection 1, by increasing the amount school districts may levy for lease arrangements from 150 to 212 times the residential pupil units. This is a $50 per pupil increase. Intermediate districts would increase by $19 per pupil unit from $46 to $65 per pupil unit. You have handouts which identify lease levies payable in 2013 and 2014 for all Minnesota school districts. And I thought you might be interested in looking up your own school district. The 2013 is last year, and that's on a vertical page. On a landscape page, you will find those payable for 2014. 2013, you'll find that is a numerical order based upon the school district number. And the landscape page for 2014, you will see, is in descending order based upon the percentage that has been used by the school district for lease levy. So you can take a look at that. You also have, I think, in your possession, a fiscal note on this proposal. In the past, lease levy authority has been granted to many districts in order to provide revenue to accommodate early childhood family education and community education programs. But in recent years, there has been an increased emphasis on early childhood education, and we now have all-day kindergarten available to all districts throughout the state. The increase in per-pupil unit lease levy amounts will provide additional facility flexibility to local school districts. And please note that all districts must apply to the Department of Education for approval when considering the implementation of a lease levy. So it is a local control proposal. However, you do have to seek approval from the department. And at this time, I'd like you to hear from Mr. Mike Bullager. He is the Director of Business Services for the Shakopee Public Schools. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome.
Thank you. Again, I'm Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Burlager, the Director of Finance at Shakopee Schools. And as you can see on your handout, we're very close to the top of your list. This has affected us. This will affect us quite dramatically. In Shakopee, we've had tremendous growth with the improvement of the Bloomington Ferry Bridge. We're just on the north side of Scott County. And with the expansion of Bloomington Ferry Bridge, we've had increased rapid growth through about 2008, and we continue to have a steady growth since then. Because of the rapid growth, we haven't had facilities to provide a all-day kindergarten option for our parents and students. And with the we've lost a number of kindergarten students to our surrounding districts because they have had the option. And with the change in legislation last year to provide full-day kindergarten, our school board has gone through the process of making a plan, and we've asked for a lease levy, which has increased our lease levy quite substantially. We're very close to about $100,000 away from the cap for our school district. With increased, we're also looking at concerns in our school district for with expanding early childhood programs that we won't have space again for that. So we won't be able to expand our early childhood programs in our school district if we don't have this increase in the lease levy. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Well, it's clear there's a need, and we're looking at levy. I believe the total is $360,000. Mr. Wilms, you want to comment on the note? And
Chairman Weegar and committee members, you'll have before you a fiscal note for Senate File 1795. As you'll notice, there's no appropriation costs to the state. This is all local levy costs, and the total, based on the fiscal note, is $360,000 in local levy costs. Again, I'd just like to note that for approval to levy this amount, it must be approved by the commissioner, as Senator Clausen had said.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When a school district that, let's say, responds to their need for a facility, when you go the route of a lease levy, do you actually kind of assume that that levy is going to be there for, I don't know, 20 years or however long it takes to pay off the construction?
Right.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Stumpf, we did the finance works in that we the bonds have a slight premium risk. The interest rate we paid was a slightly higher because the board does have the authority, the school board does have the authority not to pay the bonds. But the assumption is that the school board's making the commitment to the kindergarten additions that we're going to have to put on, and the bank could take over. If the board refuses to pay, the bank could take over the additions that we have, you know, basically pledged as collateral to the project.
Sir Stump.
So, Mr. Chairman, and do you know, I would assume that most districts, you know, are in good faith and make that payment until their facilities are paid off, or their loan is paid off, or the bonds are paid off. What I would also assume that there's probably a portion of the previous bonds that get paid off each year. So when we say $360,000, we are probably assuming statewide more more debt than we are paying off. But I wonder if, I don't know who would have that information, but, or is it just constantly going up?
Well, the bonds on our project will be stable for this addition. If we have to add more, then we would add that. But yes, we will be paying about $1 million a year for 20 years is what the
okay.
In our project, in what we've been doing. So,
Mr. Chairman, and would Mr. Melcher or Dr. Melcher be able to enlighten the committee on what the future might look like in terms of all the districts?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senator Stump. So the lease levy is an ongoing levy, and we have seen some increases over time. We know that the lease levy did increase this year in part because of the all-day kindergarten, where school districts can use the lease levy to add up to 20% onto the space that they have available in a building. So long term, we do see a gradual trend toward an increase. Most school districts are well below the maximum, so changing the maximum doesn't have any immediate impact. But there are some districts that would be affected right away. In looking at the runs, you can see that we've only have a handful that are over the maximum currently. It looks like about six or eight districts that are currently over the maximum. I would say that probably, you know, as I look at the fiscal note, this is the first time I've had a chance to look at the run and the fiscal note together, that we've probably been a little conservative in the number on the fiscal note. It appears we're only costing out the districts that are already over, rather than some such a Shakopee. They don't show up as a line item on here. So I'm guessing that the fiscal note number may be a little bit low, that we may need to revisit that.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Melcher, is the benefit to the district, or what are the benefits to the district using a lease levy, let's say, versus the potentially new modified alternative bonding?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, I think you're alluding to the recommendations from our facilities working group, and the facilities working group recommended that the building lease levy be expanded and renamed the facilities improvement levy, and that school districts have the opportunity to use this either for leasing buildings or for remodeling of existing buildings, for example, taking care of secure entrances, that sort of thing. So currently, there's a kind of a limited set of uses that you can have, and as you can see, most districts are well below the maximum there, but they have a lot of unmet needs, and I think the facilities group felt that there was kind of a hole in our overall system of funding for facilities that would allow you to add 20% onto an existing building if you needed the space, but it wouldn't let you make the entrance secure or do some other things. Maybe you've got a 100-year-old science lab and you need to update it. So the facilities group thought that the that the uses of the facilities lease levy could be expanded for other purposes, and that would allow more districts to get closer to that existing threshold. So for some districts, if you're a district that has space issues and you need to add space to take care of all-day kindergarten, this is the perfect ticket, but they're constrained by the $162 if they're close to it right now. But for other districts that maybe have plenty of room to take care of their all-day kindergarten, but maybe they need to install differences. They need bathroom facilities in that area. Well, you can't remodel a building with the lease levy. You can only use it to add space. So I think that was kind of the different tack that the facilities working group took on this.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Senator Stump?
Mr. Chairman, and if I understand that correctly, we really need both of them, continue to need both of them.
Mr. Chairman, yes, and Senator Stump. What the facilities group recommended was that we expand the uses so that the districts could still use it for leases, but they could also use it for remodeling. So we wouldn't have two separate levies. We just have one levy that could be used in the school districts would then have a choice to make. You know, did they want to use it to add more space, or did they want to use it to improve the existing space that they have?
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stump.
Yes, we'll have a separate category for that.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, what is the order of the runs? You know, how does – was it based on when a school district came into the program? I see Wayzata is at the top, and I know they just qualified for being in, so I wondered, is that how
just
the
once.
Runs were done?
Chairman Weger and Senator Bonhoff, the way the run is ordered is based on that far right column, total amount used. There's certainly a number of different ways to order this, but that's the way it was ordered, just to see who which districts are close to maxing out on capacity for lease levy. And the districts at the top, a total of eight, are the ones listed in the fiscal note.
So, Mr. Helm, so for example, Wayzata hasn't used it?
Mr. Wilms?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, Wayzata is captured in the fiscal note in terms of being prepared.
They've used
for this.
It all.
Yes.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, and Senator Bonhoff, they are maxed out.
Gotcha. Now yeah. I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berlager, just real quick, can you explain? I understand the growth in Shakopee. Can you explain how you've used your existing lease levy already?
Mr. Berlager.
Thank you, Senator Weger and Senator Pratt. The school district has in the past used, we use some to lease for our alternative learning center. We've used some to lease. In prior years, we had a lease for some kindergarten space, which we incorporated into building projects that we've had, building bonds. We've also used it to lease. The other main lease is with some of our cooperative, Southwest Metro Cooperative, Special Ed Cooperative, and I believe we lease some athletic facilities, ice arenas mostly.
So you're
Chair Pratt.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I forget the protocol sometimes. So you're having to lease for special ed and the co-op pieces as well to cover the buildings and the joint powers.
That they use, correct, Senator.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone in the audience like to testify on Senate File 1795? If not, Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 1795 be recommended pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the E12 omnibus bill. Discussion? All in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Carried. Thank you, Senator Clausen. Senate File 2524, Senator Wicklund. Grant for the Works Museum in Bloomington. Hands-on STEM education.
I guess I need to scoot up here.
Hey, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Wieger, and it's my pleasure to be here today to present Senate File Number 2524, which is a request for money authorizing a grant for the Works Museum, which is in Bloomington. It's my pleasure because not only is it in my district and quite close to where I live, but as a engineer or electrical engineer by training, I'm certainly very happy to support an initiative that would bring more funds to a STEM-related museum, which I think is a great effort to focus on elementary students and getting hands-on experiences in engineering and hopefully encouraging them to get further involved in STEM fields. And I have two people here today from the Works, and I'm not sure who wants to go first, but Jill would like to go first, and please introduce yourself.
Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Wieger, committee members. My name is Jill Mizells, and I'm CEO of the Works Museum in Bloomington. The Works Museum has been around for about 19 years, since 1995, and over the past 19 years or so, we've really refined our approach to teaching and integrating elementary engineering education. We were actually one of the first museums to actually introduce the E in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, before STEM became STEM. And we do this really through our hands-on work, through providing opportunities for children, families, and educators to design and build things. Basically, we say we want people to make stuff, break stuff, and make it better. And where can you do that better than at a museum? As Senator Wicklund mentioned, we really are a leader in elementary engineering education. And we serve our audiences in several ways. We are a traditional museum where parents and children and grandparents come in and play and learn through our exhibits and programs. But we also serve teachers and elementary students. And we do that on-site at our location through our school field trips and a series of programs designed to integrate elementary engineering education in the K-12 in the elementary science curriculum. And all of our programs meet the K-12 standards for science education, specifically in engineering. We feel that we really, and we know we have the opportunity to really help elementary teachers integrate engineering into their science curriculum. Elementary teachers are generalists. They have a general license, so they're not experts in engineering. And we know teachers sometimes even struggle to teach science, but then when you now tell them they have to teach engineering, they don't even know what that is. So we really work with them and their students to integrate these engineering concepts and designs into their work. And I was recently talking to a teacher who had their fifth grade class at the Works Museum doing a field trip on workshops and circuits. And we thought that was kind of interesting because typically that circuit workshop's for third graders. And so we asked the teacher, you know, why are you back here with your fifth graders? And she said, well, the MCAs are coming up in May. And while, yes, they did learn about circuits in third grade and the content behind that, we want to bring them back in fifth grade to reinforce that before they actually go in and take the MCA test because we know there are going to be questions similar to that on the test. So, again, really reinforcing and supporting the teacher's work. We also do this work offsite as well because we know we want to reach all children in Minnesota and especially in greater Minnesota. So we have a Works on Wheels program where we take our classes for students and our professional development workshops for teachers out throughout all over greater Minnesota. And we also do something called Family Engineering Nights where we'll offer an after-school event or an evening event like an engineering carnival. And we'll engage the parents in engineering and engineering activities with their students. Because we know that parents are the role models for their children. And a lot of times, if a child is not aware of STEM, it may just because that's not a career within that family. And so we're really working to introduce the whole family to STEM and the importance of STEM. I have mentioned working with teachers, and we also do that very specifically in training for teachers. Every year we hold an Excellence in Elementary Engineering Conference with the Department of Education, where we train about 350 educators every year on how to integrate engineering education into their curriculum. We feel we are very unique in the space of museums and STEM education because of our focus on elementary. And it is critical that we engage these children when they're young, because we know by the time children get to fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, into middle school, we lose them. We lose their interest in STEM. And an interest in STEM may drop from 57% of kids to 30% of kids. And we can't afford that drop in interest and engagement in STEM. Because we know by the year 2020, according to a Wilder Research study, that Minnesota STEM jobs are going to grow 18%, whereas all other jobs are only predicted to grow by 13%. So it's really important that we hook these kids and engage them and support them when they're young. Talked a lot about the content, a lot about engineering, but the other thing that we do, that our engineering design process and the work we do really develops, is children's critical thinking skills, especially the skills of persistence and problem solving. We know no matter what careers children choose, they have to know how to persist. They have to know how to try and fail and try again. They have to know how to communicate and collaborate with one another. And that's the other part that's really critical of the work we do, really developing and honing these critical thinking skills that all children need, no matter what field of study they're going to go into.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Senators, I'm Brenda Rainey. I'm the Senior Director of Development at the Works Museum, and I think Jill gave you a really comprehensive overview of the work we do, and we're excited to partner with the state to keep this work going, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay. Questions? Members, we certainly are aware of the need, and we're impressed with the progress. Your outreach, well beyond Bloomington. Mm-hmm. And is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Well, it's probably a matter now of whether we're going to have enough funds to continue the good work. And so we would lay this over for possible inclusion. And Senator Wicklund will entertain that motion if you'd like to make that. And I want to acknowledge just your own professional background as well. You get it. You you're an example of what we're trying to inspire in engineering, and I believe you're one of the few engineers in the legislature, so we appreciate your sharing that.
Yeah, and I Chair Wieger, just to restate, I think that STEM fields are, as Dale mentioned, the jobs are expanding in that area. We want to encourage more kids to think of it as an opportunity, and I know for myself personally, I went to a summer camp when I was in high school, and it was just for girls to learn about what engineers do, and I think those kinds of experiences stay with kids and can really form an opportunity to move on to other, career maybe, or just interest areas later in life. So I hope that we can find a way to support this grant, and thank you for allowing us to present it today. So I would move that Senate file number 2524 be laid over for possible inclusion in the
recommended to pass recommended and laid pass. Over for possible inclusion. Further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you.
Witnesses.
Thank you. Thank you, committee.
Okay. Next, Senator Wieger with Senate File 2561.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Division Members. Senate File 2561 seeks a $100,000 appropriation for the Minnesota Humanities Center, and it would go toward professional development, kindergarten through grade 12, for educators to better culturally engage their work with at-risk student populations. I have two witnesses, David O'Fallon, the president of the Humanities Center, and Rose McGee, an education program staff member. Would like to introduce President David O'Fallon.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and Senator Wieger especially. You've heard some great testimony this morning, and I just have to acknowledge I'm a past director of the Purpich Center for Arts Education, so I'm all for bringing the arts and the humanities into every kid we possibly can. Some powerful testimony there. The particular purpose that brings us to you this morning for an increased appropriation is basically this: the urgent need to reach all the kids now that we know, and you've heard a lot of testimony and seen a lot of data before, that aren't being reached. So here's the bottom line. We have a professional development program and approach that is, in fact, working now with multiple cultures, multiple communities. A professional development program for educators creates original content and material, and it's helping kids stay in school and learn. So here's a quick takeaway. We believe beneath the achievement gap is something we call the relationship gap. So even well-meaning, informed teachers sometimes can't reach kids that other programs aren't reaching. We have a program that's evaluated with a team from the University of Minnesota's Evaluation Institute. We seek to expand this program of professional development for educators beyond the current cohorts into other parts. We are a state agency with responsibility and no authority whatsoever. Nobody has to work with us. And yet hundreds of educators and dozens of school districts, in fact, work with us. So just a couple of things in the handouts that are coming to you right now. A point I very much like to make is that we're an entrepreneurial center, so the funding we get, we leverage literally two or three times more by raising private funds and using other funds. And again, we're working across the whole state, so the cohort of teachers that we seek to expand would include even more educators from across the state of Minnesota. Just a couple of quick examples of original work for communities. This is a book created with the Somali community. I don't have enough to give to everybody, but Senator, I could hand this around if people would like to see it very briefly. And one point I like to make about this is that this particular book, which was produced with the Somali community, was literature that did not exist before. So it involves the community, the educators, the families, and the kids in learning. And the USAID came to us and asked if they could reprint 50,000 copies of this book, which we said, you may do that. We thought that would be a good idea. And very recently, and you see this author on the front page of this particular handout, we created with the Hmong community new literature that did not exist before, young Hmong authors and illustrators, the third or fourth generation Hmong saying, what is it like to be involved now as an American in education? How do I find my way? This is, again, original literature that did not exist before, and we embed it and surround it with professional development programs so that the educators and the community are involved in engaging the young people, staying in school and learning. And I'll just make that one point again. We've got some great evaluation that shows that this is working. So we seek your support in expanding it. And my colleague, Rose McGee, who's a very literally national figure in community involvement and professional development, works with us at the center to do this. And I'd like her to speak for a few moments, please.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee members, I am Rose McGee. In addition to working with this wonderful man, the Minnesota Humanities Center, I've been in schools. One of the greatest challenges that our teachers have, and you know the statistics by now, even in Minnesota, over 90%, I believe, of our teachers are white, and many of them are white women. We have great challenges, and one of the things that we're able to provide through the work that we do, through the original work that we create, is assistance in how to teach, how to manage your classroom by becoming in relationship with your students. So that's one of the primary pieces of the professional development that we provide. When teachers and educators and staff come forth and say, we really aren't clear on what to do. And it's our obligation. We hear the urgency. So if we hear the urgency, how do we respond to it? We know there's an achievement gap. And if we know that, how do we provide good educators like we have here in Minnesota with the proper tools? So that's what this is about. So I am extremely, extremely in favor of moving forward with this. Because if you'll notice this sheet that you have that David O'Fallon handed out earlier, this one with those nice color things on front. There's some wonderful quotes inside. One of the greatest challenges that teachers have, if they come to a program and they get the education, then not only do they go back to their school and their staff members, they can go into their classroom, execute what they've learned, but then it becomes a bit of a challenge when the rest of the team isn't on board. And that's the piece that we really would be able to enhance as well. So not only is one or two representatives from a particular school building coming and gaining greater insight on how to become in relationship with their students and teach their students in a way that students will now be in relationship with them, and then we start to see improvement in academic achievement. But when that student then is passed on to the next grade, and if that particular teacher, if those teachers haven't received something similar, then it's almost like starting back at ground zero. So we want this to be able to become more in-depth, to become more sustainable. That's part of the critical pieces. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Wigger, could you answer one question or just clarify? You have a $100,000 appropriation. Is that a one-time or an ongoing appropriation?
Chair, it's one time.
One time. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Well, with that answer, maybe we should take a look at adding the word only in 1.6. Only 2015.
So, Madam Chair, with the oral amendment, the bill would read $100,000 in fiscal year 2015 only is appropriated.
Well, we would add that as a friendly amendment, and in fact, we could put only in front of 100,000 as well.
Okay. All in favor?
On Council's suggestion, that would be friendly.
And okay. So we'll add the word only.
We'll add that. And
okay. Thank you, Senator Wigger. Go ahead.
And Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 2561 be recommended to pass and laid over as amended. And laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
All those in favor,
say aye. Excuse me, I believe Senator Pratt.
Senator Pratt.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Who else are your partners in this effort besides the state?
We, Madam Chair and Senator Pratt, do you mean partners in additional funding, for example?
It's
like since I made the point about leveraging other funding,
yeah,
we raise a considerable amount of money from a number of private foundations and individuals. And in fact, I would like to say that when I go on about the possibility of leveraging this funding, I have a promise for the first $25,000 to match this $100,000 should this go forward. So a number of foundations, some of which I could name, but some of them don't like to be named. In fact, we even have one foundation beyond the state of Minnesota that is so interested in the professional development strategy that they're funding some of this. So,
Senator Pratt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Do you get any financial support from Education Minnesota as we're talking about teacher training? Mm-hmm. I know a lot of the other labor organizations invest in training in their members. Is Education Minnesota financially invested in you?
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, yes. Okay. They do make a grant to us, specifically for professional development for teachers. Correct.
Okay, thank you. There is a motion for this to be recommended to pass and be included. Possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Wigger. Next, Senate File 2408.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Division Members. Senate File 2408 addresses costs for remedial education, and it was brought to me by Students for Education Reform. Unfortunately, their car is stalled, the two representatives, I know they're really feeling bad right now. They might almost be here. So I would just like to speak to it for a couple of minutes, and we may just have to lay it over. But the big picture is this. Our state goal is that students be college career ready when they graduate, for the thousands that do each May and June, and most are. Thousands, however, do need to enroll in remedial courses. And we know, particularly in math, if you need remedial help, your chances are less than 10% that you're going to get a bachelor's of arts degree, bachelor of science. There's been a lot of discussion in terms of the amount of remediation that's done. We've talked about how we can reduce the amount of remediation by better preparation in the journey through E-12, but it costs a lot for students. And the Students for Education Reform, who have visited with some of you, they proposed a formula where it could be shared a third with the department, a third by the student, perhaps that's in scholarship, or a third that could come from the post-secondary institution. There is a estimated fiscal impact, which is nearly $16 million, I believe. And so I wanted you to be aware of what was initiated from the students. And I believe we have some here right now, Madam Chair, if they would like to. Yeah, well, welcome. And just laying some foundation, and I do not have an amendment or anything. The bill is basically a third in the sharing remedial costs. And as witnesses approach, I wanted to remind persons that many years ago, former chair of this committee, Senator Pogemiller, he had proposed a chargeback to the school district, that if a student needed remediation, okay, but then there would be a chargeback to that school district for whatever it took, sort of an implied warranty that if you had that diploma, that if you're going to need remediation, then the post-secondary school. I know there's a lot of back and forth as to, is this a cash cow for post-secondary, or are they underprepared or what? But Students for Education Reform, they're presenting their ideas, and Madam Chair, I'd like to have them introduce themselves in the order that you'd like. So, Latasha?
Thank you, Senator Weir.
Hi, Madam Chair. My name is Latasha Gandy, and I am the Minnesota Program Director for Students for Education Reform.
Hello, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Kenneth Abon. I am a student at the University of Minnesota, a junior studying political science, and I'm also the Minnesota State Captain for Students for Education Reform.
Give your testimony.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much for having us here today and allowing time to hear our testimony. I'm going to start with my own personal experience. I started off with ESFR as a college student at Metropolitan State University. I went to Arlington High School. I graduated top of my class. I was an AP student. I had a 4.2 GPA, and I made it to Inverhills taking remedial courses immediately upon entrance in both English and math. I remember feeling hurt, disgusted, like a failure. I mean, any kind of word of negativity you could think of, I felt that way. Because I had been told my whole life that I was a super bright student and that I was going to be the most successful in my class. I mean, I was even voted most likely to succeed by my school body. So, I mean, I never had any idea that I was not ready for college. I never had any idea that I wasn't going to be a success or that there would be a struggle to be successful in my college career. So when I found myself in college taking remedial courses, it took a lot for me even just to get past the pain and the hurt of being let down. It took a lot for me to fight on, to keep going, and knowing that I could be a success even though everything before me had not been successful. At the same time, I had two daughters, a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old, and quitting was like failing them at the same time. So quitting really just was like one of the last resorts, and I never did it. But I also think about my 10-year-old daughter who struggles to read right now. And I did everything I was supposed to do as a parent, send them to school because it's the law, think that the schools were going to make sure everything was great and that she was being prepared and that she was going to be a success. And I went to every single parent conference. When they told me she was struggling, I was there to ask them, what could I do? And now she's in fifth grade, and at best she'll be a third grade reading level by the end of the year. It hurts. It hurts more than I can even tell y'all to know that no matter, even though I did everything I was supposed to do as a parent, go to conferences, go to the school, make sure she was there every day, moved her when one school wasn't a success, she's still behind. And the likelihood that she'll catch up in time for high school, there's a possibility she won't. And I know this. No matter how hard she works, there's still a possibility that she won't catch up because she hates reading now. So when she makes it to college and she has to take remedial courses, is that my fault? Is that her fault? As a taxpayer, I put money into the schools. I paid what I was supposed to do for her education. So why would I have to pay for it again? I already did it as a student, and I don't think it should be happening to any student. And then some people say that these students don't care about their education because of their behavior and they're acting out. That's probably a sign of struggle. They may not even know that they can achieve. They may not even think that school is for them. They may look at themselves and think, oh, I'm always in trouble, so I can't be a good student. Or I'm always getting a bad grade, so I can't learn. It doesn't mean they don't care about their education. They're struggling. So that's my testimony on my story.
Thank you, Ms. Scandy. And I think you articulate from a parent's perspective and from a personal perspective some of the things that we deal with in this committee. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
So as you can tell by Tasha's story, this is a very emotional topic for us all. But she's also not alone. There are many, many students that have to
Excuse me, can you just say your name again for the
record? I'm sorry. My name is Kenneth Abon. It's for Students for Education Reform. As I was saying, many students go through this. If you want to go ahead and take a look at the first page on the pack of the packet, it says background information and why. 54% of students that attend community colleges and technical colleges end up taking remedial courses. And then 22% of the students that attend four-year colleges in Minsky end up taking remedial courses. So this is a large problem that we do have to face. And it's difficult to say that all those students have to pay the full amount, and it's their entire responsibility to take care of this. So it's not only about as Tasha illustrated, it's not about the number, the cost all the time. It is about the emotional tax, but at the same time, we do know that college is a barrier for many, many students, especially students of color. And when we tag on these extra costs for remedial courses, it becomes a little bit more of a barrier. And we want to see like the finger pointing stop and us all to take responsibility. And that's why in our bill we've decided that we wanted to see it be split up one-third to the state or MDE, one-third to the higher ed institutions, and then one-third on the student, so that we're all taking accountability, we're all taking part of the burden, and we can really try and figure out and stop blaming students and stop blaming one institution for all of our issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wigger, do you have more testifiers? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I didn't introduce myself earlier. My name is Mike Blazinen. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota. I grew up in Western Bloomington. And just thank you for offering me this opportunity. When they asked me to testify, the first thought that ran through my head was that I am by far not the ideal candidate for this testimony. I don't have an emotional story like Tasha's, where the system was really set against me. Like I said, I grew up in West Bloomington. I come from a very privileged background. And I went through my educational experience blindly and very trustingly. Everyone always told me that I was really smart, really talented. My teachers and my parents would always assure me that I was doing well. I was on track for everything. And when I reached junior and senior year of high school and I started actually sort of paying attention to where I was at, I discovered that that was actually true. Academically, I was in the top 1% of seniors in the nation. And so I discovered that even though I had no idea where I had been all these years, I was ready. And now that I'm at the University of Minnesota, I don't have to take remedial courses. But many of the testimonies that we handed out in that packet in front of you, they start the exact same way, where people are assured year after year that they're ready and they're on track, but they end very differently. Jamesia, she felt ready to take classes as soon as she graduated high school to take college classes, but has ended up paying thousands of dollars to take remedial courses just to be ready. Reginald took AP courses just like me and has had to take several remedial courses, taking significant chunks out of his college funding. And Kulia was always told that she was highly intelligent, but still has had to pay for needed remediation. So I'm here because I believe that this is not fair. Students should not be forced to pay the full burden of these remedial courses when they've been assured by everyone that they trust that they are going to be ready and are going to be on track, which is why I'm urging you to support the Senator Wieger's bill to help pay back some portion of remedial courses. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this bill in the Higher Ed Committee, too, and I really appreciate the sentiment and have been inspired by the students. And I look at it as though everybody has a stake in our students' success. So the student has a stake in it, the family does, the school district does, and the higher ed institution does. But, Senator Wieger, when I first saw this concept, it wasn't the state, it was the school district. And to me, it's a disconnect. I don't understand why the state would be on the hook rather than the school district.
Senator Wieger?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, you're correct. It could be either one. We recognize the pushback there would be from either group when we had that debate earlier, but if you did assign that cost sharing to the local school district, it would be more direct. The state also works, though, in the context of standards and expectations for college career ready and working with the students. I let them write the recommendations ultimately, but it could go either way. The process is that there be some shared participation in costs which are overwhelming.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, and I would be interested in what other members around the table think, but it just seems to me that the state is pretty far from the actual teaching and learning experience. And so I think this is an important discussion. I don't know whether or not this will end up in the final bill, but I think if we are having the discussion, it's a more accurate description to talk about the relationship between, what's happening in the actual classroom. So that would be my preference.
Yeah.
And I would be interested in hearing around the table before I'd offer it as an amendment.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had the pleasure of meeting with Mr. Avon since the higher ed testimony, and we had a really good discussion about this. I really support the general principle behind this, but some of my questions, similar to what Senator Bonoff has expressed, part of it is we are in a transitional mode right now on this subject because MNSCU is implementing a changed process. So, I think we need to look at this sort of over time and how things would phase in. One of the things that Ms. Dandy testified in the Higher Education Committee that I think was really telling was that I think it was in math you said that you were tested and found to be leading the remedial courses, but you really, in fact, did not. So it was a testing problem in that particular case, and that there's been information shared that sometimes students show up and there's sudden, surprise, you have to take a test, and they weren't even aware they were going to have to take, so they were not prepared, they didn't brush up on some things. And so it seems like there are some other steps that we could take to maybe improve the overall process. I do think the cost-sharing discussion is a very important one, but hypothetically, just making up numbers here, if we did find out that a much more substantial burden was on flaws in the testing process, for example, well, then to be penalizing the school districts might not be appropriate at this ratio.
And so anyway, I'm just throwing out a bunch of different ideas that I think we could integrate into a more sort of nuanced discussion and solution, because I do think this is really, really important that we do this well.
Senator Weaker, did you have a response?
No, very no. Thoughtful
okay.
Advice, and you know, I'd like to actually get Commissioner Pogemiller's insight on this as well. And again, he was an advocate for full participation at that local district, and in his role now in higher education and in linking with the E-12 system, I know he understands the importance of readiness and fairness. I think at this point we don't have a formal fiscal note. We have a fiscal impact that was prepared, I believe, by Mr. Wilms. Mm-hmm. My suggestion is that we, here's any additional testimony on this, but lay it over, and there be continued discussions, perhaps with interested parties, but particularly with Senator Bonoff as the division chair, and see what interim steps might be taken to address a very serious need from students, parents, guardians, and others. And I know this has dashed a lot of dreams of kids, of young adults, of people maybe mid-career that are trying to get their life together. And with what happens, there's some real gripping testimonials. You understand that. So,
thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard this testimony in higher ed as well, and certainly we heard about the flaws and shortcomings of AccuPlacer that was causing some of the remediation. But I've got to agree somewhat with Senator Bonoff in that this lets districts off the hook. West Bloomington did a fine job. You were ready for college. Your local districts failed you. Your teachers failed you in this case. And in some cases, these are the districts where we're spending the most per student to make sure it happens. And Ms. Gandy, I can't remember if it was you or the other young lady that testified that you were taking AP courses, never offered an AP test. You didn't know you were behind until you got your ACT. Was that you or was that the other
one? Yeah, and I didn't even know I was behind. And my score in my ACT, I didn't know that equated me not being prepared. No one even discussed that with me.
And so I kind of wonder,
as we
say your name again.
Thank you. So I kind of wonder, as we went through last year and we tried to talk about minimum graduation standards tied to the ACT that didn't pass. We talked about I think I called it a high school warranty at the time that we offered as an amendment around this issue that didn't pass. And I just feel like, we've got to hold local boards, local schools, local teachers to be accountable, right? Because they're the ones that failed you. They're the ones that didn't provide you the ACT test that would have given you an indication that you weren't meeting the standards. They were the ones that didn't implement plan or MAP or any of the other testing or give you the results in a way that they knew the data to help you out. And so, I would certainly like to see us again put some minimum standards around graduation. Senator Weaker, I know you and I don't see eye to eye on this. You believe that, as you said on the floor last year, we've got a lot of standards and credits that need to be satisfied, but unfortunately they're not being met at a level that ensures proficiency, and we're graduating these kids not ready for the next level. So I guess there's really not a question there, more of a statement.
Okay.
But
okay.
I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Sure. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think at first reading, it sounds quite simple and easy to do. But, in that remedial portion that higher ed, that you hear from higher ed, I think it would be better to start out with some additional information. Like, I think it would be possible that higher ed could track where these students are coming from so that you could identify the districts that are actually maybe not doing as good a job. And the other thing that we worked on a number of years ago, which for some odd reason seems like it's impossible to actually, you know, put in place, is that the higher ed system and the E-12 system have a very difficult time to work together in terms of their testing and in terms of their outcomes and in terms of their expectations. So, you know, one problem with the way this is, so you graduate from high school, you know, and maybe top of your class, but then you leave education for a period of a number of years and then you come back. Well, what's the slippage there? There's slippage just from the summer to the fall, and a significant amount. The slippage is much greater if you're, you know, take, you know, 4 years and go into the Peace Corps or military or something like that, and then you come back and you're trying to recoup the math skills or the language skills or whatever. I mean, you can't expect the high school to imprint your information and knowledge so deeply that you'll never forget it. So I think we need to have a better connection between the higher ed and the high school, and I think we need to have some information from higher ed, which I think is there. I mean, they can tell us when those students need remedial, what district did they come from. You know, you can even go back and identify which teachers that they had. But I think at least the school district, so that you can actually then look at assessing those districts if you want to go that route, which I, you know, I think that's a possibility.
Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Stump. Again, I'm thinking of Commissioner Pogamiller, and with the longitudinal data through the SLEDs, the $1 million appropriation that went through, it's to track that type of information for each student, and I'm going to encourage that dialogue for a closer monitoring of what's being done. The bill, as the students did write this, it does require within 2 years of graduation. I understand the use it or you lose it, but you know, within 2 years, you would have to complete that remedial after graduation. And if any of the students...
Yes. Thank you, yes. Madam Chair.
State your name again, please.
Tasha Gandy. I have a couple of things, just comments coming off of everyone's statements. First, about the fact that the district should be charged, individual schools. Personally, I do blame my teachers for lying to me and never telling me that I wasn't being taught college material. And I do blame my principals, and I get upset about that. But the problem is low-income families and underrepresented families are highly mobile, not by choice, but by force. So we at Esford do not feel it's fair to charge the district, because what if that student wasn't in that school the whole 4 years? What if that student was only there for the last 3 months? And that wasn't the teacher's fault. That wasn't the principal's fault. I happen to have went to Arlington for the whole time. But I do know that a lot of students that go through these remediation process, they're highly mobile, and they still shouldn't be punished for that. Their family economic status is not their fault. As far as the remedial placements, my English remedial placement was absolutely needed. I didn't know how to put commas. I didn't know how to make a proper sentence structure. Okay, my first paper had red on every single crevice of the paper. My math, I needed remediation. I just didn't need a whole semester. So I could have just had some additional help and been successful there. But I still needed remediation. And then also I think about, like, you guys talk about the years, like how many years after school that you go. One of the testimonies she was provided was by Natasha Reeves. Natasha went every year after school, after she graduated, and tested with the Accuplacer. And each time she was told that she was below level, so she did not enroll in college. She did this for 4 years until she finally said, forget it, I'm going to enroll, I'm going to get remediated, and I'm going to be successful. So there are students that are out there that are taking this Accuplacer test and being told they're not ready, and just that emotional toll on that makes them not even continue. So I argue that they're not waiting years to go. They're being told they're not ready, and they're thinking that maybe if I just wait a little bit longer, I'll be ready. But they're not given what they need to get ready.
Okay.
That's Senator all. Wicklund?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. My comment was just going to be that I think this is an important issue, and I think we should keep discussing it. I know a few years ago when my daughter was getting close to graduation, she graduated in 2007, and I looked at the report that that has been done that contains data on exactly how many students need remediation from or attend remedial courses from each high school or district. I don't remember. I think it's by school, actually. And I was really quite surprised at the district I'm in, at Bloomington, Jefferson, and Kennedy. There were, you know, a considerable number of students who were taking remedial courses. And I think somehow we need to connect back to the schools. And I certainly understand mobility is a really a big issue. And so there needs to be some discernment about how to tie it back to the schools. But I think the school districts and local level officials need to be involved in this too, because they need to be able to react to, you know, what are the factors influencing their kids.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just some general thoughts. You know, I came onto this committee with actually no background in education. You know, I didn't serve on school board or anything like that, like many of you have. And I'm just going to throw a few things out of general impressions of what this discussion really has brought to mind. And I had a visit with these young men yesterday in my office, and I appreciate Kenneth's comment about not wanting to blame anybody, but at some point we do have to stand up and take responsibility for a system that's fixed. And the comment that I want to make here at this point is that I think, quite frankly, that the state of Minnesota has the concept that if we just throw enough money at everything, we can make the problem disappear. And I think we are seeing that just putting money out there isn't the answer to everything. As Senator Pratt indicated about some of the school districts that get the highest amount of money are having some of the worst problems. There's a lot more serious problem there, and I think to what Senator Stumpf commented about, you know, the cooperation and the interaction between post-secondary and E-12, you know, I think, quite frankly, I would have a problem, Senator Pratt, with the idea, and Senator Bonhoff, with putting that third strictly on the school districts, because I think, quite frankly, this body has to shoulder as much responsibility as anybody. And I don't think we can just write a check and say, oh, taking care of all the needs. It's sort of like a divorced parent writing the child support and saying, well, I've done everything I need to do to take care of that child. We know that's not the case. And so I think that the problem that is reflected by the issue that's brought to us is really a lot more serious than just what this one bill can solve. So,
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What a great discussion. So thank you to those who have brought this forward, because you can hear the richness of the debate. I just wanted to let members know that there's this report called Getting Prepared that hasn't been that's the report that you're talking about, Senator Wicklund. It actually stopped being done for the last few years, and now the Office of Higher Ed has taken it back up and invested a great deal of time and resources into having it be a state-of-the-art report that is going to easily show us where students are at, which schools they came from if they need remediation, and that report is due out the end of March. And so I think just seeing that report will give us the opportunity to look at the data and figure out then what's the policy perspective once we see the data.
Well, Senator Weger, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, it would be to lay over.
To lay over at this time, pending additional information.
The motion is to lay over Senate File 2408. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And Madam Chair,
thank you
you to the testifiers. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
And we're done. We'll meet tomorrow at 8:30 sharp.
Tomorrow at 8:30.